The minimum wage for wait staff has not changed since the early 90s when I waited tables between college 91, and law school.
91 to 93, yeah. Somewhere in there. It's like $2.13. Yeah.
$2.13 an hour 30 years ago. And that pay has not changed. Job certainly hasn't changed. It's a tough job.
In the interest of the corporate bottom line, drivers like myself become homeless while Uber and Lyft become billionaires.
I spent most of my early adult life waiting tables and taking care of kids as a single mom. So I know what that's like. So my goals are really to marry things like economy, healthcare, and environment all together.
We just are really doubling down on these school board races to make sure that we have people sitting on that school board who not only support public education, but who support racial equity and want to make sure that all children have an equal opportunity for a good education.
This is another Labor Radio Podcast Weekly Extra, a bonus edition of our weekly roundup of highlights from more than 70 labor radio shows and podcasts. With Election Day now just 4 days away, those shows have been highlighting labor candidates and issues across the country, way more than we could fit into the regular weekly. So we've been releasing a series of extra editions featuring some of that coverage. On My Labor Radio, which comes to us from WELT 95.7 FM in Fort Wayne, Indiana, we get an update from the campaign trail with Chip Coldiron, who's running against the two-term GOP incumbent in Indiana's 3rd Congressional District. We'll also hear from Marty Lemmert, Indiana State Rep candidate for House District 52. From Workweek, based in the Bay Area in California, we'll hear from drivers who held a protest earlier this month to oppose Proposition 22, which Uber, Lyft, and the app companies have already spent more than $200 million on. On the Working to Live in Southwest Washington podcast, history professor Donna Sinclair, and candidate for Washington's 18th Legislative District in Olympia, talks about how historians play a role in determining what's fake and what's real. Public education has come under fire nationwide, according to American Federation of Teachers Vice President and Ohio Federation of Teachers President Melissa Cropper. She talked with America's Workforce Union podcast about elections in Ohio and why Joe Biden is a better candidate for public schools. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on today's podcast extra of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices with a selection of highlights from the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Here's the show.
From studios in a secure location on the south side of Fort Wayne, Indiana, you're listening to an independently produced program presenting the views of working Americans. And now, here's your next episode of My Labor Radio. Let's check in with the My Labor Radio host. Hey, Mark.
Here's my interview with Chip Coldiron.
Great to see you, sir. Thank you for giving me some time. Earlier in the month, you were at a rally at the Courthouse Square with the Nasty Women of Allen County. That was a rally for women, but I still love that title, and those ladies have taken that to honor themselves with that. Talk about how some of that went.
Yeah, so the Nasty Women's event, they brought together around 15 or 20 different candidates that are running here in Northeast Indiana and throughout the state, because Dr. Woody Myers was there as well.
Yes.
So brought together a lot of good candidates, and we all had, you know, a few minutes to speak there, and I got to speak later in the afternoon. So it was a great time. There was a really large crowd. I think I, you know, personally counted like 200 people. I was just taking it back to myself.
Yeah.
And so a really large crowd, a really good opportunity to talk to the people of Fort Wayne and the Nasty Women. They are fired up for change here in Northeast Indiana. They have helped me tremendously with my letter writing campaign.
Right.
They've kind of pushed us over the top to make sure we get all those out. And they're continuing to back my campaign and back the campaign of other Democratic candidates here in Northeast Indiana that are trying to make change. That's what they're about. You know, they want to see progress for not only women, but for minorities, and just, you know, make Northeast Indiana a better place. And that's what their goal is. And I think they're doing a great job of promoting those, that agenda.
you can't lose sight of the fact that in 2017 and then again in 2018, there were hundreds of thousands of women marching in Washington, D.C. Let's not forget that. You talk about all the counties, and we're quite a big area. There's 12 counties in Indiana's 3rd District. Is that correct?
Yeah, 12 counties.
As you've gotten out there, talk about some things you've learned when you go out to some of these rural places. You know, we talked about, okay, Fort Wayne's the biggest city in all of it, but talk about some of the things you've learned from folks as you go to outside of Wells County, where you're at right now, or Allen County. You're going out there into the areas and starting to talk to those folks. What are you finding out?
Yeah, so each county kind of has their own issues that are need to be addressed. When I went to the Jay County meeting, I think it was in January, they talked to me about the problem with drugs down there, with heroin and young kids being addicted. Mm. So that's one issue for Jay County that I would need to, you know, help figure out is trying to solve the drug issue there as best as I can as a member of Congress. And then, you know, like I've got Adams County, they were asking me about flooding because they have a lot of flooding issues over there. So every county has their own issues that, you know, a representative really needs to be locked in and listening. And that's, you know, that's part of being willing to go and do your town hall meetings. Right. And that's, you know, what I'm pledging to do. You know, there's 12 counties in our district. There's 12 months in the year. You know, I'm going to hit at least one county a month for every month I'm in office. So just going and listening to people and what they have to say and trying to help make their lives better. That's what being a representative is about.
I think at Norwell, you are inspiring some student body folks there because they're seeing it firsthand. Hey, there's Chip. There's Mr. Coldiron. He's running, which is a cool thing. And then, heck, when you win, well, then they're going to be blowing up about it again too. So that's got to be a really cool thing too.
Yeah, I actually have kids concerned about if you win, Mr. Coldiron, how are you going to teach here now? And so I kind of have to like go through the whole process. Like, I'm actually going to be in Washington, D.C., so I won't be able to teach here for a little bit. And they're like, you're not going to be my teacher anymore? What? No, that's not going to. So they're kind of like split on being excited for me running and winning. But then at the same time, if I do win, you know, it's like.
They lost you. Yeah.
So I get some of that there at Norman, which is kind of cool as well, because it makes me, you know, I'm doing good on both fronts. I'm doing good as running for Congress, but I'm also doing good as their teacher. And that's, you know, that's really the number one priority right now is to make sure that I'm being their best teacher that I can be. So.
That's Chip Coldiron, candidate for Indiana's 3rd Congressional District in this election cycle in 2020. You heard it here first. He's working to be a U.S. Congressional Representative for Northeast Indiana, but he's also working to be the best teacher that he can be. He's a veteran, a teacher, and a leader.
The things that I'm running for are exemplified, frankly, by the cause of Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she said that women deserve to be anywhere decisions are being made. The laws that I would like to write would give not just women, but all marginalized communities a voice where decisions are being made and a place at the table.
That was the voice of Marty Lemert. She's running for Indiana State Rep in House District 52.
I've been a labor, employment, and lawyer for over 25 years. Now, I graduated from Case Western Reserve Law School in
Cleveland, baby. Go Cleveland.
Yeah, I'm a native Clevelander.
Perfect.
I graduated there and I started working for unions. My first 4.5 years of practice was as a union side labor employment attorney. So I've been on both sides of the fence.
Yeah.
I came out here to Fort Wayne and I started working management side at that time. Mm-hmm. And that was over 20 years ago. So I've seen both sides. I've worked on both sides. And what I see here in Indiana is an imbalance in terms of the legislature and the laws that are being passed, where collective bargaining and power and unions have been eroded over the years by intentional and deliberate actions on the part of the state legislature. And that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I say that as a person that mainly represents companies, but right. I do believe that workers should have the right to join a union and they should have the right to bargain collectively in good faith with their employer. Now, right. I get it that companies need to be able to make money. Okay.
It's always been that way. We can't avoid that. That's why we want to work together with them as union members.
But they make money when people are doing well enough to go out and buy their goods and services. You need people to be doing well enough and earning enough money to be out there consuming. Mm-hmm. We saw with this pandemic, when everything shut down, we lost a third of our GDP,
right.
Just like that.
Poof, and it has not come back either.
It has
not come
back.
Let's not fool ourselves. Yeah, true.
People, you know, you can open the bars and restaurants, but people are not going to go out until they feel safe. So you can't have an economic recovery until you have a recovery from this pandemic and you get it under control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's so disturbing about the lack of leadership on that issue. I did an op-ed for the Journal Gazette not long ago where I talked about the fact that the minimum wage for wait staff has not changed since the early 90s when I waited tables between college 91. And law school.
91 to 93, somewhere in there. It's like 2013. Yeah.
$2.13 an hour 30 years ago. And that pay has not changed. Job certainly hasn't changed. It's a tough job.
You've been listening to My Labor Radio's continuing conversation with Marty Lemert, who's running for state rep in House District 52 in Northeast Indiana. You can find out more about her campaign at lemertforstaterep.com. L-E-M-E-R-T, the number 4, staterep.com. Thanks for joining us on My Labor Radio. Make your voice heard. Go vote.
This edition of My Labor Radio was directed and edited by Mark Gavart. My Labor Radio executive producers are Mark Gavart, Rhetus Thomas, Jeff Patterson, and Gary Snyder. Thanks for listening. Remember, take care of each other at work. You know the boss won't do it.
This is KPOO San Francisco at 89.5 FM and KPOO.com on the internet. Next is Work Week.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, a union town.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Work Week. Today we will hear from Uber and Lyft drivers and trade unions who held a protest on October the 15th in San Francisco to oppose Proposition 22, which Uber and the app companies have spent over $200 million on. It would eliminate the protections in AB 5, which forced these companies to provide workers' compensation, Social Security, disability, and unemployment. But first, we go to the Uber protest on October 15, 2020, where over 300 trade unions and drivers marched and rallied against Proposition 22.
My name is Erica Maghetto, and I've been a Lyft driver for nearly 4 years and 10,000 rides. I'm so honored to be here today with my fellow drivers from across the state. When I started driving years ago, I thought rideshare was an okay gig. As time went on, pay cuts became more frequent and maintenance costs began to mount. I was forced to work 62 hours a week just to squeak by. And I speak for myself and hundreds of drivers I know when I say I'm sick of being bullied by these companies. Instead of rewarding those of us who've worked for Uber and Lyft for years, they cut our bonuses. Uber and Lyft deactivate drivers and discard people in the name of profit and in the interest of the corporate bottom line. Drivers like myself become homeless while Uber and Lyft become billionaires. And when I say drivers like myself, I mean, I know what it's like to feel thrown away like broken tools in the Uber and Lyft toolbox. My partner and I have been housing insecure for nearly a year now. We've been bounced between sleeping in our car, at campsites, and at Airbnbs. And it's been a real struggle. We work hard for these companies and all they do is bully us. They steal our lunch money and they violate our basic labor rights. Prop 22 would legalize the bullying. It would allow gig companies to continue to mistreat and underpay us. But we're not going to let that happen. benefits and a voice on the job. Thank you to my fellow drivers who came all the way from San Diego. Thank you to the drivers that came from Los Angeles. And finally, thanks to my comrades from San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, and Sacramento. Prop 22 is a threat to not only my life, but to the lives of all drivers and the safety of our community. We are workers who deserve basic labor protections. I'm fighting for my rights and I'm voting no on Prop 22.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek. And with me this afternoon is Edward Escobar. He's with the Alliance for Independent Workers and drivers who are organizing to defend themselves against the gig economy and the app economy. Edward, why don't you talk about what's been going on with the fight around Proposition 22 and your battles to defend drivers and fight these companies?
Well, first, thanks for having me, Steve. Always championing the people in the trenches. Yeah, our Drivers Unite movement, we've been challenging this whole misclassification of employment from the get-go. When drivers, gig workers, were complaining that they were receiving poor pay and poor treatment, those were symptoms, and we always knew that from the beginning, that the core problem is misclassification of employment. You call a person an independent contractor, but yet you are treating them worse than a part-time minimum wage employee. So, and then what's happening right now is that you have the workers that are brought in by the hiring entity, and the worker, basically, you have two classifications. You have the independent contractor status or the employee status. And what's happening is that in order for these gig companies to scapegoat on contributing their fair share to the employee safety net, or the worker safety net, rather, they're calling the worker independent contractor, but they're controlling them. They're controlling them worse than if they were part-time minimum wage employees. And these workers, as employees, misclassified employees presently, have no rights, protections, or benefits whatsoever.
And Proposition 22, there was a rally last week against it by union people, some drivers who came from throughout California. Following that rally, some things happened that are very concerning to you. Why don't you talk about what happened?
Well, it's interesting because the collaborations that we've had and some of the video coverage and the work that was done even by your production team, when it was featured on our national Uber Lyft Drivers United page on Facebook, then immediately after that, then they took down our page. And we were not provided access to that page on Facebook anymore. We received an email contact from Facebook stating that we needed to resolve this matter directly with Uber. So Uber corporate had targeted us. I guess they are that desperate and they're doing that poorly when it comes to trying to pass this yes on Prop 22 that they feel the need to target advocates like our organization and remove us from being able to contact our own base in terms of support that we use social media to exercise that right.
So you're saying that the Facebook, the company, allowed Uber to say that using the name of Uber Lyft drivers was a violation of their copyright? What does this mean for other union organizers, other groups that are Amazon that are trying to organize using the name? Does that mean that these companies could do the same thing?
It's quite possible. It seems like that they're given carte blanche to do whatever the heck they want, and there's no due process, because I was not given any advance notice so that we could address this. If someone from Uber would have contacted us and said, hey, we have a problem with this particular aspect of your Facebook page, can you please change that? But that was never done. And I know exactly why, because right now we're in the final weeks prior to the November election, and they're getting very desperate. So they're basically pulling out all the stops and trying to silence social media platforms that have traction, that are putting the word out there about these gross violations of workers' rights.
And Facebook also gets funding from Uber. Is there a commercial connection, financial connection between Facebook and Uber?
Oh, I could definitely see that because Facebook runs so many ads for Uber, and they spend a lot of money, not just Uber, but Lyft, DoorDash, Instacart, Mates. When they're spending more than $200 million to make this yes on Prop 22 as successful as possible, then they, of course, they'll spare no monetary amount in terms of investment. And if you stop and think about it, the general public should know better to support any type of action like that, where these corporations that I mentioned, Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Postmates, Instacart, this is self-serving. This legislation benefits them exclusively. They get a special carve-out, and they could proceed as they choose. And what they'll be doing is they'll continue to use, misclassify these workers as independent contractors. They're going to be given the legal right to continue to use that word improperly, that classification, because a real independent contractor sets their own rates, terms, and conditions. That's not what's happening here. These folks are going to be controlled. They're going to be dictated the rates, terms, conditions on how things are going to happen, and they're not being given the proper protections and rights of that type of control that they should be in return.
I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with Edward Escobar, the Alliance for Independent Workers, and Drivers United. So thanks for joining us on Work Week, Edward.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Next up is the Working to Live in Southwest Washington podcast from the Southwest Washington Central Labor Council, hosted by Shannon Myers and Harold Phillips.
Someone else who's very concerned about getting the right information to people and making sure that discourse is civil is history professor Donna Sinclair. She's also running for the state legislature in the 18th district. Thanks for joining us, Donna.
Harold. Hi, Shannon. I'm excited to be here. I just want you to know.
And we are excited to have you. Donna, how does you being a historian fit into this idea of being a smart media consumer?
That's a great question. As a historian, what we do is look at primary sources. Primary sources are the materials that come from a time period. So that means that we're looking at the news from the past, oftentimes, both the fake news and the real news. And so being a history professor means that you are essentially trained to read through those documents to determine what's happened, what's true. So one of the best skills that a history student comes out of a degree with is the ability to read several documents, corroborate their evidence, and glean from that what's true and what's not true. History is not about opinion. It's about documented evidence that tells us about what's happened in the past. So that's my short answer, but get me started and I'll give you a longer one.
Now, how is your training as a historian going to be applied to your job when you get elected to the legislature?
Again, historians take thousands and thousands of documents and look at them in order to draw conclusions, to figure out what has happened in the past. And they learn to do this in a systematic way. They learn to actually find out what happened first, what happened next, right? So when you have thousands of documents that you have to condense into something like a 400-page book or a 200-page book, it requires you to really dig in and figure out what's important about that. That's what you have to do with public policy, too. You have to talk to a lot of different people, and you can talk to them about their experience, and that's something that I've done. But you also have to know, what are the laws? What are the rules and regulations? And how do those things fit with people's experience? Again, we draw from all of these pieces of evidence in order to really determine what's happened, how it's happened, why it's happened, and what it means. I think the same kind of skill set really applies to being in the legislature.
I know that it takes a lot to step up and run for office in our community. So tell us, Why are you running?
Well, I'm running for office because I care about our communities. It really comes down to that. And at the very beginning of this, when Harold introduced me, he said that I'm someone who cares about civil discourse. Part of what happened for me is I saw the breakdown of civil discourse in our society. People were just hammering on their own issues, not talking to each other. It was divisive. And then I realized that at the local and state level, our representatives were entrenched in ideological positions rather than working on behalf of the community. Right around that time, there were a lot of people saying women should run for office. My mother did ask me several times to run several years ago. And I said, I have no desire to do that. I do not want to be a politician. I have no desire, but I have a background and experience that really prepared me to do this kind of work. And as an adjunct professor, I had some flexibility. So I started getting involved in the community about 4 years ago. So I decided to run for the school board because that's a natural fit for me. And it's great experience to take to the legislature. So that's why I decided to run. I care about the community. I want to create a better future for all of us here in Clark County. And the 18th is really affected by everything that happens.
What are your major issues that you're focused on?
My major issues are affordable and accessible health care, better public schools, and I'll take my education experience there to work on that, and an economy that works for all of us, right? I used to be a waitress. I spent most of my early adult life waiting tables and taking care of kids as a single mom, so I know what that's like. So my goals are really to marry things like economy, healthcare, and environment all together and really work toward getting a North County Vocational Technical School put in place. I think there's a lot of opportunity to do things that have to do with green technologies, for example, and construction in North County, not just at Cascadia Tech in Vancouver.
I'm really glad that you mentioned your early experience as being a waitress and doing childcare, because I think people see someone who's a history professor and they think that they live in an ivory tower. But the reality is, you didn't start out there, did you? You had to come from someplace. And it sounds like you've done a variety of jobs over the course of your life.
Well, I grew up in a family that had a restaurant in Long Beach and one in Vancouver. And at age 11, I started bussing tables, washing dishes, then became a backup cook, and then I became a waitress. And while I was a young mom, I was waiting tables till I was 30 while I started school. And by then I was divorced. It took me until I was 50 years old to get a PhD. And I did this by juggling several part-time jobs. I've been an adjunct most of the time. I'm not a tenure track professor. I make less money than most people who are waiting tables right now. I have to make choices about where I teach based on whether I can access healthcare or not. I was driving to Western Oregon University because in the state of Oregon, I could get healthcare. Even though I love WSU, go Cougs. We have such a dysfunctional healthcare system that someone who has a PhD is hired as a part-time worker at a university that really likes me because the jobs that are full-time with benefits are limited deliberately.
I hate to hear that this is happening in our educational system as well, because we know this happens in all kinds of corporations where they keep people at a certain amount of hours, just under enough to where they're not qualifying for benefits. And then they say, hey, go on down to the state plan and hook yourself up with some benefits. And who is paying for that? The working people.
Yeah, but you think about stores like Walmart doing that, not a college.
It is not the employee's fault that they don't have health benefits. It's the fault of the employer and the corporations who are not providing benefits for those employees.
Well, the reality is that around the country, universities are hiring half of their faculty as part-time adjuncts. There are stories about adjuncts sleeping in their cars and being on food stamps because the pay is so low. So I'll tell you right now, I make $4,000 a class at Western Oregon University for the quarter. So that's for almost 3 months of work. So it's $8,000 over the course of 3 months, but I get benefits there. I make less than that at WSU Vancouver, and I can't even access the benefits. I'd be happy to buy into the system if I could, but I can't even access those good Washington State benefits.
Even though you're a history professor, which seems like a really white collar kind of job, you're actually in the same boat as a lot of working people in our community and a lot of working people around the country. How do you expect this to influence the way you're going to work in Olympia, Washington State Capitol?
When I say I want an economy that works for all of us, I'm talking about gig economy workers. I'm talking about Lyft drivers who can't get access to good health care, especially if the Affordable Care Act gets overturned. That's really going to be a problem for people who can't access basic health care. Our foundational public health systems have been incrementally chipped away at. We need a system that allows everybody to have not just a health care plan, but access to health care.
Thank you so much, Donna. And thank you for joining us, Working People, for another episode of Working to Live in Southwest Washington, produced by the Southwest Washington Central Labor Council.
And don't forget, this podcast was recorded under a SAG-AFTRA collective bargaining agreement. To find out more, come visit me at swwaclc.org.
And remember, Working People, this is your show. We want to know what you want to hear on it. Email us at podcast@swwaclc.org or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at SWWACLC.
And I know you listeners want to make me happy. So subscribe, hit the button, subscribe, and then pass it on to your friends and family. Thank you.
And give us 5 stars or thumbs up or whatever your platform of choice gives you. One more thing. Look, it's okay to be passionate about the people you support in this election and your side of the political argument. But remember, we're all on the same side. We're all Americans. And facts matter. Be sure you check your sources before you share that thing online. Misinformation might make us all feel good in the short term, but it damages our country and our communities in the long run.
Or you could do what I do, which is I post pictures of my cute little chickens and bunnies and kids and support my local candidates.
Or you could do what Shannon does. Either way, we'll see you next week.
Bye!
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Let's go to our live line right now. Melissa Cropper is president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, and she is doing her part to get out the vote. Hey, Melissa, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us today. And I understand you're in Cleveland, Ohio right now. Is that right?
I am in Cleveland, Ohio right now, yes. We're here with AMT. It's here on a bus tour that they're taking across the country to support Joe Biden in this election, and they're now currently in Cleveland.
Very good. Yeah, I saw the bus yesterday, and it's labeled AFT Votes. AFTVotes.org is a website if you want to get some more information. And you're just one of many unions doing the same kind of thing. Let's talk about what's on the ballot. Let's start with the state school board elections, and the OFT has endorsed some incumbents there. Let's run them down and why you're backing them. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, there are 5 seats we're interested in that you are playing very heavily in. 2 of them, like you said, are incumbents. One is Merle Johnson from right here in the Cleveland area. She was a 42-year teacher in Cleveland Metropolitan School District. And she's just been a real force on the state school board since she's been on there. Holds our values. She knows what it's like to be a teacher. We need her, you know, need voices like hers on the board. Same with Antoinette Miranda, who's from the Columbus area. She's back as an incumbent. Both of those, I think, are going to do quite well in the election. Not as concerned about them. But there are 3 seats that we really need to pick up. That's Christina Collins, Michelle Newman, and Mary Benegar. You know, there have been a lot of weird things going on with our State Board of Education. There's about 5 ultra-conservative people on the board who have been going after our state superintendent. They don't like the vision for schools in Ohio, which the vision is about taking care of the whole child, meeting all the needs of children. They consider it a socialist plan. And most recently, they have been, attacking the resolution that the State Board passed on, erasing racial equity in the state and making sure that we have a fair curriculum and fair opportunity for all students, regardless of where they live or the color of their skin. But they have really just been packing the past few school board meetings with people who are anti that racial equity agenda. So for all those reasons, we just are really doubling down on these school board races to make sure that we have people sitting on that school board who not only support public education, but who support racial equity and want to make sure that all children have an equal opportunity for a good education.
Yeah, I'm reading that you testified supporting that resolution, which was passed by the state board. Now, in their testimony, they said racism doesn't exist, or they didn't want this taken up at all. What's the problem
here? They deny that there is any structural racism whatsoever, and particularly not any structural racism in our education system. So, I think you and I could talk to a lot of people who could tell us differently about that and who have experienced that racism. So for them to be sitting there denying this is really just quite outrageous.
Melissa, I have to ask you, these people that you're talking about, do they have any experience working in the schools? You mentioned like Merle Johnson, 42 years a teacher. Obviously, these are the kind of people that you want on the board, people that know what education is and how to educate kids. What about these five that you're talking about? What's their backgrounds?
Well, one of them is John Hagan, who used to be a state rep, who was a very conservative state rep at the time that he was on the board. Another one is Sarah Fowler, who we've talked about before on this show, who is a homeschooler. She was homeschooled herself, and so has never had an experience being in a public school, and has been quite a strong advocate, actually, for the the charters, homeschooling, et cetera, and things that are not supportive mm-hmm. of our public education right. system. And she's currently running to be a state rep also, which is quite frightening. And the other three also don't have any experience with being in public education.
That is so wrong. How many people altogether on the State Board of Education?
There are 19 people on the state board. Did I get that right? There are 11 who are elected and I think it's 10 who are elected and 9 who are appointed or something like that. I should know that better.
Yeah.
But
okay.
Yes, it's some kind of balance like that, yes.
Yeah, and it's important because obviously the board sets the policy for the schools here, so we got to get the right people on the board. Let's move on to the Ohio Supreme Court race, and we've got two people here, John P. Mm-hmm. O'Donnell and Jennifer Bruner, that the OFT has endorsed. And obviously, you've endorsed them because the people that they're facing who are now on the Supreme Court support voucher legislation. Is that correct?
Right. Justice French was actually the lead counsel on the pilot Cleveland school voucher case that started the voucher programs in Ohio. So we know, obviously, she's not going to, if any more cases come before her, we already know what direction she leans on the voucher issue. And Kennedy also has been instrumental in these voucher cases in the past. So, that's our primary reason. But obviously, there's a lot of other reasons also that they're just not labor-friendly judges. And in this time, we've seen our courts continually be packed over the past 4 years with anti-labor, anti-public education judges. We have to use every opportunity that we can to make sure that we're getting justices who are worker-friendly, who understand the value of public education. And quite honestly, in Ohio, they could play an instrumental role in the whole redistricting piece also. So, I think oftentimes people don't go all the way down the ballot mm-hmm. and get to these Supreme Court judges, but there are a multitude of reasons why we have to make sure that we go all the way down the ballot and capture those two Supreme Court judges who are at the very end of the ballot.
We should point out there's 7 judges on the Ohio Supreme Court, or justices, I guess that's the appropriate term. Now,
correct.
If O'Donnell and Bruner get elected, that will tilt the balance of the court to a 4-3 Democrat side. And that
correct.
Could really be beneficial to workers. There's no question. Long time coming. All right, the biggie here, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I understand that you're all out for changing the people at the top here. And as president, no surprise. I was reading earlier on the show what Joe Biden would do for public education. I'd like to hear it from you, Melissa, because it would be, it's like a 180 turn, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, without question, he is a huge supporter of public education. You know, his wife is a public educator, having taught both in a high school and in community college and still teaching in community college. So they really understand firsthand the value of public education, and not only understand the value of it, but, you know, having Jill understands what it takes to be a teacher, what goes into being a teacher. And so to have someone like that sitting in the White House would be extremely important. He's already committed to tripling Title I funding. And so, you know, just to give you a little bit of taste of what that means, back when IDEA and Title I were first passed, like 40 years ago, there was a commitment that Congress would fund this, or the federal government fund it, up to 40% of the cost. And they've never gotten up to above 18% of the cost of this. So it's been, you know, crippling our school districts for years. IDEA is the money, and the title money is the money that goes to our poorest districts to help bring equity in the districts, and then IDEA helps with the special needs students. We've never had the funding for those kind of programs that we need, and quite honestly, those are the programs that cost our schools the most. So to say you're going to triple that funding, that makes a huge, huge impact on our schools, as well as a huge impact on our communities who continually are trying to pass levies. You know, we've got this unconstitutional school funding program that relies so heavily on property taxes in Ohio. If we triple this funding from a federal level, that takes a huge burden off of local taxpayers.
Right.
So that's, you know, right there in and of itself is a big reason why we are supporting Joe Biden. And then obviously we are always battling this private school, you know, voucher versus public education. He definitely falls on the side of public education and making sure that our schools have all the resources they need, rather than funneling these resources away from our public schools into a private school program. So, and yeah, then the list goes on as far as why Joe Biden is best for workers. So it's just a no-brainer in our book as to why we need to be electing him.
Thank you for what you're doing, Melissa Cropper, president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, OFT-AFT.org, and that bus tour, AFTvotes.org. You can follow them there. You take care. We'll talk to you next month, all right?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.
That's going to do it for this special podcast extra of Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our bonus edition of our weekly roundup of highlights from more than 70 labor radio shows and podcasts. With Election Day now just 4 days away, those shows have been highlighting labor candidates and issues across the country way more than we could fit into the regular weekly. So we've been releasing a series of extra editions featuring some of that coverage. The Labor Radio Podcast Network shows focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, and you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Evan Papp and Patrick Dixon, produced by me, and our social media guru is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net. Find out more on our website, laborradionetwork.org. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show.